It's my pleasure this morning to introduce a wonderful teacher and writer and also somebody who's been a very good friend of mine for many years. Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardozo was educated in Amsterdam. He was ordained at the Gateshead Yeshiva in northern England. He is the dean of the David Cardozo Academy in Jerusalem. He's the author of many books, as well as articles which have been published in various newspapers in Israel and abroad. And a sample of those articles is available for free outside the door. Rabbi Cardozo travels extensively at this point throughout the world to lecture on Judaism and on Israel, and is really one of Judaism's finest ambassadors. Please welcome Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardozo.
Good morning, everybody. I'm sorry to tell you this lecture will take 4 hours and 33 minutes. I want to thank, first of all, my dear friend Elliot and Rabbi Jay for inviting me over here. It's always beautiful to be with them. And before I start, I just want to make a little point concerning the next lecture which I'm giving. I just want you to know that. The official name of that lecture is not the one exactly which you have in front of you. It is a much worse name. It's about the righteousness of God, and the original title is God is not righteous, and the Torah is not moral. And we will there deal with some very important issues from a very different perspective than you ever heard. Let me straight away get into our topic. Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza as he's called in the Hebrew world, and the Kotzke Rebbe, Reb Mendel Meikotzk, one of the great Hasidic leaders a few hundred years ago, and myself. That may sound a little arrogant, but there is a very good reason behind that. In short, I have been raised in a very assimilated Jewish kind of family in Amsterdam, totally secular in every sense of the word. And to tell you the truth, I'm a child of a mixed marriage. My father was Jewish, a Portuguese-Spanish Jew. My mother came from a Christian family. And when I was born, I was not yet halachically Jewish. I considered myself Jewish, as my brother did. I have a brother 2 years younger. And we were raised in a socially secular Jewish community, cultural Jewish in every sense of the word, spoke the Jewish language, the Jewish way of doing things, but it had absolutely no connection whatsoever with the Jewish tradition. And one of the things which moved me into the Jewish tradition was actually this man called Spinoza. And Spinoza, as you obviously all know, must be considered to be the greatest secular philosopher coming from a Jewish background. He was definitely a Jew, 17th century Amsterdam, and breaks away from the Jewish tradition when he's already quite a young man, brilliant, genius, knows a word for it, we would call him an Ilui in the Hebrew world, and a man who could not make peace with the Jewish tradition in any way. Openly started to say what he felt was wrong about the Jewish tradition, and these were not mild observations. They were very difficult to accept. They were incredibly critical. And things got to such a bad situation that the Parnassim, the Jewish community, the Portuguese-Spanish synagogue in Amsterdam, decided to pronounce a ban on him, which by far is the most famous, or if you want to call it infamous, ban ever pronounced by rabbis at any time in Jewish history. Nothing better can happen to a person, I'm working on that myself for many years, to get a ban, because afterwards your books are much better read, much better sold, but you have to be a Spinoza to be able to achieve that goal. My father was a follower of Spinoza, very proud about his Jewishness, but again from a secular perspective, felt that Spinoza had the truth, and I was introduced to Spinoza's philosophy when I was 14, 15 years old. And how strange the world is. When I started to read his famous work called the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, which is his main critique on the Torah and on the Jewish tradition, it made me to wonder if he was telling the truth. And I asked my father about that, and he really did not know. He did not have himself very much of a Jewish education. And he told me, go and discover, find out. So I started to speak with people who were experts in Spinoza, and there were also one or two in Amsterdam who were also experts in the Jewish tradition. And slowly over the years, I started to realize that the story was quite different from the one which Spinoza was actually somehow elevating. And when I was 16 years old, I decided, you know what? I think I need to become a religious Jew. I went up to the chief rabbi of the Sephardi community in Amsterdam. He was called Chacham Shlomo Rodriguez Pereira, another one of these fantastic Portuguese names. All Maranos from many years ago, coming from Spain, Portugal, after the Inquisition. And I told the Chacham, I think it is time for me to make Giyur, to convert officially. I consider myself to be what today they call a father Jew, but my mother was not Jewish. And to make a long story short, I converted. Also, to be quite honest, I always considered myself to be Jewish, and so did the whole Jewish community. The only trouble was when I went to shul, I couldn't be counted in the minyan. Anyway, I have a brother who is 2 years younger than I am, who nearly converted, but on the end he didn't. But I should also tell you, just to make the story complete, many, many years later, and no doubt because of myself, my mother also converted, and my parents were married by the same rabbi I was married with the difference that they were already married for about 40 years, and I got married 3 months after my parents got married. No other child ever achieved that goal. Anyway. Spinoza is a marvelous thinker in every sense of the word. And you know that besides that he wrote the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, he wrote another work, which I think is much greater, and that is called the Ethica, or the Ethics, which is his most marvelous, deep philosophical concept by which he broke with every traditional kind of philosophy up till now. And in fact, he became the first secular Jew in history. He did not convert to Christianity, wouldn't think of it. And some people consider him to be an atheist, who denies all the foundations of the Jewish tradition, which is open to questioning, and perhaps if we have time I will say a few words about that. But why do I give this lecture about Spinoza? What is there so important about it? Now, obviously, it is true that Spinoza is a most important thinker if you want to understand modernity. He is the father of modernity. But what bothers me, and what I find very important, is that there is also a tremendous warning flowing forth from the story of Spinoza. I'm very afraid, and I've spoken many times about it from many different perspectives, is that we are today busy again to create new Spinozas. And that's not what we need. That's not what we need. And I will tell you a little bit about the man and about my encounter with him and in his very philosophy, and to see what went wrong, why somebody walked out on the Jewish tradition as he did. He was never prepared to come back again. Completely disconnected himself from the Jewish tradition, from the Jewish people, to the point that in his Tractatus, he writes about the Jews like they, the Jews. He doesn't even somehow include himself anymore into this. Interesting, and this is typically the Jewish experience, is that he considered himself no longer to be Jewish, and the whole world around him called him the Jew from Forburg. Forburg was the place where he lived. The Jew wants to run away, and on the end, the rest of the Gentile world reminds him that you are just as Jewish as you always have been. And even Spinoza had to encounter that problem. It's very symptomatic in many, many ways. Now, Spinoza is somebody who I read more or less every day. I have a chavruse with him, if you know that expression. I do that mainly after I come home from shul, after I have said my shacharit prayers, my morning prayers. And then I read for half an hour about Spinoza, who tells me there is no God, there is no Torah, there is nothing at all of all that. And you understand that creates some kind of interesting tension. And I can only tell you, try it, it is marvelous. But how did it happen that a man breaks away in such a radical way from this tradition? He didn't see anything good in it. Really turned his back on it and never walked back again. The ban was devastating. Today, I have experienced that myself. People sometimes, or rabbis, put bans on people. And I must tell you, it's a childish event. If a rabbi today, or rabbis today, put on other rabbis bans, this is actually a marvelous thing, because it indeed means that more people start to read your books. And it has absolutely no effect. But in these days, in the 17th century, it had a real effect. Because what it meant was that when you lived in a Gentile community, like in Amsterdam, and you were told that you're no longer to have any connection with the Jewish community, and you could not have any connection with the non-Jewish community, you were really an outcast. There was nobody to speak to. And Spinoza experienced that. There was nobody to speak to. He moves out of Amsterdam, lives in The Hague and later Forburg, and writes his marvelous works over there, and dies, by the way, as a young man. He was ill. He dies, but he leaves these two and many other things behind which have changed the world. Now, to understand this, I want you to, for just a moment, to take you to Amsterdam. You have to understand, Amsterdam is a highly unusual Portuguese-Spanish kind of community. I dare to say, and I agree I'm biased, that it is the most remarkable community in all of the world. Today there's nearly nothing left of it, because the whole thing was wiped out in the Holocaust. Nearly nothing left there. I suppose some of you have been in Amsterdam, you have seen the Portuguese-Spanish synagogue, which we call the Esnoga, which is the Portuguese name for synagogue. It's more or less a museum by now, but it was before the war a very powerful community, and definitely in the 17th century, when the Jews came from Spain and Portugal after the Inquisition, where they were all forced to live a Christian Catholic life, as you all know, and run away. And many of them come to Amsterdam, and Amsterdam was one of the very few places in this world at the time which was open and liberal enough to allow the Jews in. And so they settled down there. But the first thing you have to realize is this. The Jews who came to Amsterdam, they were halachically Jewish, that's true, and according to Jewish law. But they had not the slightest clue what it meant to be a Jew. They were all trying to get back to this tradition, but for hundreds of years, they basically were raised as Catholics in the Catholic Church. Some of them tried very hard, secretly, to keep some Jewish law, and I'm sure that you've all read about this. But the overall situation was that they were Catholics. They lived a Catholic life, they went to church, till some of them, quite a few of them, got enough of it, got out. My family, for example, did so, and many others, and came to Amsterdam because this was the only place you could really settle. If you walk around in Amsterdam, or just outside Amsterdam, there you will find, very worthwhile visiting, by the way, the cemetery of the Portuguese-Spanish synagogue, where they have been burying their deaths for hundreds of years. called Ouderkerk, which is the place, the city where that cemetery is found. Beit Chaim. Have a word or walk around there for a moment. It's again a very special, unusual, disturbing, strange cemetery. Why? Because if you walk around and you look to the tombstones there, you see tombstones there which don't belong in a Jewish community or in a Jewish cemetery. Many of them are pieces of incredible art where you see whole sceneries in the marble somehow shown all sorts of human figures. You see Yaakov Avinu on the ladder, famous story in Tanakh, in the Torah. You see Moshe Rabbeinu receiving the Ten Commandments. You see all sorts of things which are actually, they must have been tremendous artists to make these kind of tombstones, and people are buried there under those tombstones. Half of this tombstone is in Spanish, half of them is in Hebrew. But there is one there which is absolutely unbelievable. It is the one of Samuel Dexera, and also a Portuguese Spanish Jewish name. He's called Shmuel, Samuel. And if you look to his tombstone, who do you see there engraved in the marble? Nobody else but HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. In the form of a human being who is speaking to Shmuel, to Samuel, and according to the story as it is found in Tanakh, where he tells him to become his prophet, his shaliach. And there he is, God himself, engraved in a Jewish cemetery, in a total violation of Jewish law. Total violation. And that sets in motion loads of questions. How is that possible? The answer, my friends, is obviously this. It may be that the rabbis didn't even know about this, that this was happening. But what it meant was that if you walk around there, and I say this with the greatest amount of respect, my parents are buried there. By the way, the parents of Spinoza are buried there, a few hundred meters away from my parents. Then you sometimes think that you're walking around in a Catholic cemetery and not in a Jewish one. And nearly this is obvious. The reason is that when these Jews came to Amsterdam, they were sinking in completely Christian Catholic terms. That was their world. And when they were trying to discover what it meant to be a Jew and to find back their Jewishness, they seemingly felt that the difference between Catholicism and the Jewish tradition was minor. It is some kind of Judaism, is some kind of Christianity without the cross and with a few halachot here and there. But when it comes to the main principles of belief, Christianity and the Jewish tradition are not very far away from each other. How did they get to that? Answer is very obvious. For hundreds of years, they did not know anything else. And they have never studied any Jewish texts properly. And however much the rabbis tried to introduce this all to them, it took obviously a long time before they would change their mind. And we are speaking here just after they had come from Portugal and Spain to Amsterdam. And therefore there is a community here which exists out of a very strange kind of human being. A Jew is a Catholic. A Jew thinks in Christian terms, but wants to be Jewish above everything else. Now there's something else also. Spinoza is not the only one who has a ban on his head. Truth about it is that they used, and I'm not exaggerating at all, they used to throw about bans left and right in these days, so that there were thousands of them. In fact, it is a known thing that even the rabbis put bans on each other. One of the people who got the ban, by the way, was Menashe ben Yisrael, the man who later brought the Jews under Cromwell back to England. And anybody who dared to do anything which was a violation of Jewish law or was not in the spirit of the Jewish tradition got himself into a ban. Straight away, the Parnassim, the people who were leading the community, which in the Portuguese Spanish synagogue is called the Ma'amat, which is the lay leaders kind of community, they would straight away pronounce, sometimes for a day, sometimes for a month, sometimes for a year, they would pronounce bans on people. Why did they do that? Well, they did that because they had to lead and they had to deal with a kind of Jew which had never appeared in history ever. People had come from Spain and Portugal who did not know each other. Most of them didn't know what it meant to be Jewish. As I said, many of them were thinking in Christian terms. Others considered themselves not at all to be religious and were not interested in becoming religious. They just wanted to be part of the Jewish community, because if you were not, you were not belonging to anything at all. The non-Jewish world didn't allow you to get in there. And therefore, to make sure that out of this bunch of very difficult people living on the fringe, people who had all sorts of different ideas, some people being interested in religion, some people not being interested in religion, and so on and so on, the end story was that the rabbis had to deal with a rebellious amount of people over there, which they could only keep under control when they would use all the force they had to put these people in their place. And how did they do that? They did that by way of the chirim, by the ban, because the ban was the worst thing which could happen to you. You were no longer part of any community at all, definitely not of the Christians in Amsterdam, and definitely not anymore of the Jews. So where were you going? Nowhere. And therefore it worked perfectly, except that obviously quite a few people paid a heavy price, and one of them is Spinoza. I would say, and forgive me for saying so, what happened in Amsterdam is that the rabbis, together with the Parnassim, created their own Inquisition. The only difference was they didn't burn people at the stake. They stopped at the ban. That was the worst thing which could happen to you. But the concept of an Inquisition, of a religious body which somehow put you in your place in case you did not behave, yes, that was exactly the case. Just give you one little example, no time to go into all the details. There's a case now where somebody got a ban, you know why? Because he was doing business in London. He was living in Amsterdam, and he went to London to do business. And the Parnassim found out afterwards, when he came back home again, that he had not gone to shul every morning in London. And he got a ban. Don't tell the rabbis before they start doing this here. But that's the way how it worked. There are four cases where somebody got a ban which was never lifted ever. One of them is Spinoza. Perhaps the greatest tragedy within that community. Why? Well, there are many different ways of looking to this, but there are two things which we have to keep in mind. Spinoza created an incredible problem to the Jews in Amsterdam. First of all, there was an agreement between Amsterdam City and the Jewish people who came, or the Portuguese Spanish Jews who came to Amsterdam, where they said, you can come to Amsterdam, build your synagogues, marry among yourselves, under one condition, and that is never create any problem for us, the Christians, the liberal Christians. We don't want anybody to speak against Christianity. We don't want anybody to try to make Christians into Jews. We don't want any problems whatsoever. And in case you do make problems, there is the door. And then Spinoza openly starts to write and to speak about his thoughts, which was not just a critique on the Jewish tradition, but it was also a critique on Christianity. Only the very liberal kind of Christians at the time, they could live with him. But the rest got very upset. The Jew of Amsterdam and later Forburg, is making us an incredible amount of problems because he's attacking Christianity. And the Parnassim at Amsterdam said, if we allow this to continue like that, then it brings all of us into great trouble, because it probably will mean that one day the city of Amsterdam will turn to us and say, there's the door. You didn't keep by the conditions which we had at the time agreed on. And I'm sure that this was perhaps the most important motivation, not the only one, why the Parnassim decided, together with the rabbis, to put a ban on this man's head. And if you read that ban, by the way, which is incredible how harsh it is. Never was a ban written in such terrible terminology as in this particular case. But looking into the personality of Spinoza, Spinoza is brought up really in a community which really did not know what to do with itself. Christians, Catholics, Jews, atheists. It was all there, and there was more of that stuff we will see in a moment, which was all made into, let's call it by a very nice Jewish Hebrew name, an incredible balagan. That was basically what it was. People had their ideas, people spoke. Loads of also people were put into Gerem, into a ban. It was an ongoing situation, and this brilliant young man, brilliant by all standards, sees all that, tries to make sense out of all this. On one side, Catholic theology and dogmatic attitudes. On the other side, Kabbalistic ideas. Then Maimonides walks in. It is a big, big mixture of all sort of different things, and he is not able to make any sense out of it because it doesn't fit. It contradicts in many, many ways. And slowly but surely over the years, while Spinoza in the meantime also starts to study Greek philosophy, and I remind you that just before his days in Amsterdam, there lived another very great non-Jewish philosopher by the name of René Descartes, who influenced Spinoza greatly. And was the first man who was slowly breaking out of the authority of the church, which at that time was unknown. It is Spinoza then, the next generation, who breaks really out altogether and becomes indeed completely secular, to the point that he denies the biblical existence of God, as we Jews know. He creates what today we call, that's not, by the way, a completely correct name, but that's the way how it is called, pantheism. We'll see a little bit later more about that, which basically denies the personality of God. There is no point in speaking to God, because God is really the sum total of everything, but not more than that. Or as we call it in Latin, Spinoza wrote in Latin, by the way, his Latin was terrible, Deus sifa natura, God is equal to nature. That is a breaking point, as far as the rabbis are concerned, with the Jewish tradition. And he denies after that that the Torah was written by Moshe, by Moses. He denies that it was divine, it was all written by human beings. Actually, it was very simplistic, all that stuff. And he walks all out together, and he gets very involved with some of these liberal Christians living in Amsterdam, but then needs to leave Amsterdam because of the ban, and lives the rest of his life with a liberal Christian family in Forburg, just outside The Hague. There were three rabbis who play a role in his life, and we better keep an eye on these people. And again, not just because of the, let's say, the history behind all that, but because of some important matters relevant to our lives. There are three rabbis there. One is the one I just mentioned, Rabbi Menashe ben Yisrael, who, by the way, interestingly enough, is the most internationally known rabbi of these days, connections everywhere, also with the Christian world, who is not there when the Gerem is pronounced in the synagogue on Spinoza. Which definitely could make us to question if the Gerem actually would have been there if Menashe ben Yisrael would be there. Impossible to answer that question. But he probably would not have been a man who would have pushed this idea. But there were two other people. There was a Sephardi rabbi, Portuguese-Spanish, who was called Rabbi Yitzchak Aboaf de Fonseca. He is actually the man who later built the Portuguese-Spanish synagogue in Amsterdam as you have it today. The other person is an Ashkenazi rabbi by the name of Rabbi Shaul Levi Mortera. He's an Ashkenazi. Very interesting. By the way, the reason why there were some Ashkenazim involved in these days is because there were one or two rabbis in Amsterdam before the Portuguese Spanish came to Amsterdam who taught the Portuguese Spanish, and that's the reason why there are some Ashkenazi minhagim customs till this day within the Portuguese Spanish synagogue. But whatever. The thing was that between these three rabbis, there is also a lot of tension. Menashe ben Yisrael is a strange figure because it is not exactly clear where he stands on all matters, but he's clearly also very deeply influenced by Christian thought and really writes in this kind of language. Some very important works, but if you read them, you sometimes wonder if it was the Pope who wrote them or it was this Rabbi Menashe ben Yisrael. But he was a typical Jew. By the way, Menashe ben Yisrael was painted by Rembrandt, who lived more or less next door to him. The other two rabbis were opposing forces. And that is this, that one of them, the Fonseca, was a Kabbalist. He was very involved in Kabbalah and believed, therefore, example, also in the fact that just at the same time, and keep that in mind, that Sabbatai Tzvi had just pronounced himself to be the Mashiach. Actually, Spinoza writes about that. And many of the people in the Portuguese Spanish synagogue at the time were followers of Sabbatai Tzvi, thinking that he was the Mashiach. There was one who was totally opposing all that, who is living a little later. He's called Jacob Sasportas. But the other man, who it is not clear if he was or was not in favor of Sabbatai Tzvi, is indeed Rabbi Mortera. Rabbi Mortera is a typical Maimonides follower. A Maimonides follower means to say he was considered to be a rationalist, because Maimonides was considered to be the great rational thinker within the Jewish tradition, which he no doubt in many ways was. But Spinoza is educated by all of them, but there is an emphasis there, no doubt, on Mortera, who seems to have had the greatest influence on him. But this Mortera had one problem. That was, number one, he was an Ashkenazi, which was not taken in good spirit at the time. Number two, he constantly spoke, and you have to understand what that means to a young man like Spinoza, about punishment when you did not live up to Jewish tradition. And one of the things he, by the way, said, that anybody who was not circumcised could think about straight away going to Kehinam, to hell. Now, don't say this to the Portuguese Spanish, because when they came to Amsterdam, many of them were not circumcised. And many of the people who were left behind in Spain and Portugal will never be circumcised. So that did not sit well with the Portuguese Spanish, and he kept on speaking about it, and he made an incredible dogmatic attitude, which clearly must have influenced Spinoza. But the biggest problem is this. Mortera, Rabbi Mortera, is a disciple of Maimonides. And Maimonides is the greatest Jewish philosopher, no doubt, a religious philosopher. But he's also the most disturbing one. He's the most disturbing one because he does a few things with the Jewish tradition which are highly problematic, which most people today are not even aware of anymore. I've written about this in great lengths, which got me into tremendous trouble, which is great. As you know, Maimonides created the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith of the Jewish tradition, which till this day we sing Friday night in the shul, Yigdal Elohim Chai. It's based on the 13 principles. And there Maimonides puts down 13 dogmatic beliefs of the Jewish tradition. And he says, if you don't believe in all 13 of them, you're not a good Jew. And he's very clear about that in his writings. But when Maimonides writes these words at the time, most of us today have totally forgotten about it, he himself got himself into major trouble because of this. Because many of his colleagues and many great people at the time said, Maimonides, from where do you have the authority to write down certain principles of Jewish faith? Since when did we have principles of faith? There were never dogmas in the Jewish tradition. Look in the Talmud. If the Talmud really, you want to see it as a dogmatic kind of literature, be aware that there are not 13 dogmas there, but there are a few thousand there. Because Maimonides could have taken authors also in the Talmud, where certain rabbis make certain statements about what they think you need to believe. But it's also very clear that this very Talmud tells us about other rabbis who said, no, you don't need to believe this at all. It's all open to debate. Yes, we believe in God. And yes, we believe that the Torah is min ha-shamayim, is from heaven. But what that means, and put that in dogmatic little boxes to say this is what it is and this is what it is and so on. Where in the Jewish tradition did we ever see anything like that? And they were very right about this. Probably the reason why Maimonides wrote this all down is because the Christians at the time and the Muslims at the time, who had their dogmas, challenged quite often the Jewish community and said, this is what we believe in. And what do you believe? And you know what the Jews answer typically? Not sure. Not sure, you know, we live in according to halacha. We believe this came from Shamayim, this came from heaven. But if you tell us exactly what it is that we believe and we don't believe, this is all up to debate. But the Jews started to become very uncomfortable about this. Because they started to realize that they couldn't really dispute anything with these non-Jews. Why? Because there was nothing else on the other side which they could use to show, no, this is what we believe. So what does Maimonides do? And one has really to understand this well. Maimonides therefore says, you know what, let me write down what I think is possibly the 13 principles of Jewish faith to just help these Jews out when they stand in front of the Christians and the Muslims. But Maimonides seems to do that in a way which is really very difficult to understand. He does that in a way by which he makes this so dogmatic that there is no dispute possible anymore. And therefore he gets himself into trouble. I tell you an interesting thing. When Maimonides died, somebody wrote on his tombstone, here lies an heretic. A mean, we say in Hebrew. And why did they write that? Because they said, if you create certain principles of Jewish faith, that's heresy. That is not something which helps the Jewish tradition. In fact, it is undermining the Jewish tradition. But over the years, this all started to be forgotten. And suddenly now we are left with certain principles of the Jewish faith, which everybody seems to tell us that we must believe in that to be really good Jews. While in fact this is very much a question, a tremendous question, still open till this very day. Jonathan Sachs, the chief rabbi of England, once told me, he's a good friend of mine, he says to me, you know, this is the reason why we don't say the 13 principles, but we sing them. And it's a very clever observation. Because if you sing something, it means to say, you don't take it really, you know, the music takes it out of the context of what you are stating. It becomes something different. And therefore we sing them. And he's so right about this. It's marvelous to sing them, but you should never say them. Because it doesn't belong there at all. But Rabbi Mortera didn't know about that and didn't want to hear about that. Rabbi Mortera told Spinoza, if you don't buy into exactly the 13 principles, Spinoza, you're a heretic. And this brilliant man just couldn't go along with that. And I fully understand that. Because who says indeed that it's all as dogmatic, if in fact the whole Jewish tradition doesn't reflect that? That was one very big problem with Maimonides. I read you a statement by a very famous professor of Jewish philosophy by the name of Leon Ross, who was at the time in Hebrew University a major figure within Jewish philosophy. He writes like this, for this Hebrew of Hebrews, meaning Maimonides, had in many respects a Greek mind. Maimonides had a Greek mind. And through his sense of logic and passion for precision, exact, he brought the whole of the Jewish tradition in a doctrinal crisis
the echoes of which are with us yet. And my friends, I completely agree with that. Maimonides brought the Jewish tradition into tremendous trouble with the 13 principles of faith. It shouldn't have done that. A dogma does not belong within the Jewish tradition. There are beliefs. A dogma is a little window like this, where you can see perhaps only a little bit of the enormous thing called the Jewish tradition, where there are so many differences of opinion. Dogma cannot be replaced or cannot be something like a deeply religious experience. When the Jews walked out of the Red Sea, the Yam Suf, and they sang there, As Yashir Moshe, the beautiful song which we say every Shabbat morning, or every morning actually in the Shachrit, right? Why did they sing that song? They sang that because at that moment they had such an experience of God that they had to express it on a spontaneous level, and these words came out. They didn't sing the 13 principles of Maimonides because it didn't fit to the religious experience. That's not what Jewish tradition is all about. It is faith. It is deep feelings from within. It is the upheaval of your soul. You can't put that into dogmas. So by doing that, Maimonides indeed created a crisis. And we still pay the price for that. Because today, if God forbid anybody would speak against the 13 principles of Maimonides, he is considered no longer to be a good Jew. But there is more. Maimonides did another thing. It shows his absolute brilliance, but it also shows the great problems he actually created. And I don't have to tell you, Maimonides is by far the greatest, most marvelous philosopher we had within the religious world. And he still plays an enormous role, and I read him every day, and I study him every day. Every word that he writes is of tremendous importance. Nobody will deny that. But there is another side to the man. Not only is he writing the 13 principles of faith, he also writes the greatest codex of Jewish law, which is a violation of halacha. Why? Because what Maimonides does in the Mishneh Torah, in this incredible work of his, the Code of Jewish Law, which, by the way, today, if somebody would write the Code of Jewish Law, which is completely covering the whole of Jewish law, you would today, I'm not exaggerating, you need 100 rabbis, 100 years, and they will not come up with such a great compendium as he did. You know how Maimonides wrote the Mishneh Torah? He writes himself in a letter. He used to write this between one patient and the next. He was a doctor. So in a few minutes in between one patient, he wrote another halacha. If you look into this work, you will think that he's day and night busy with that. But the man had the Talmud on his fingertips, everything, with all the interpretations at the time available. And he writes this in a lucid Hebrew language, which is so beautiful. It's nearly poetry. And there it is. And when Maimonides publishes these works, the same thing happens again. Tremendous critique. Where do you have the authority from to finalize Jewish law and to codify it? Since when is Jewish tradition and Jewish law codified? It was always up to discussion. It was always that there were many opinions, minority opinions, majority opinions in the Talmud which were discussing these things because, as you all know, the Talmud is one big war among the rabbis. What is it exactly? What is the halacha? One said the halacha is like this, another one said the halacha is like that. And there comes Maimonides, and he decides the halacha in according to one particular opinion. And he leaves out all the other opinions. You never hear any more about them, with one or two exceptions. And there it is. And therefore he gets the whole of the rabbinical world on his hands, because they all seem to ask him, from where do you have the authority to do anything like that? But because of his brilliance and no doubt his integrity, over the years, the Codex of Jewish Law of Maimonides becomes the standard work and now has become the last say on matters of halacha, which is exactly what should not have happened. But it did. And then a few hundred years later, we have Rabbi Yosef Karo, who writes the Shulchan Aruch, which you all know about, who does more or less the same thing, slowly but surely, partially relying on Maimonides. The authority of Maimonides must have been unbelievably big to be able to do this somehow. And he writes the Shulchan Aruch. And today we say Orthodox Jews live in according to the Shulchan Aruch. Yes and no. Because if you just look into the side commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch around the major text in the middle, you will see that so many people disagree with what Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote. But the whole thing got codified, after all. At least it made the impression. It reminds me of a fantastic story I once personally experienced when I was learning in Gateshead Yeshiva in England, which was a Haredi, ultra-Orthodox place, where I learned there for 8 years. I had mainly, because I came from a non-Jewish background in school, I went always my whole life to a non-Jewish school. I had friends still from these days. One of them one day phones me and says to me, Nathan, in Dutch I'm called Nico, Nathan, can I come and visit you? I would like to see a Talmudic college. What are you doing over there? Today he's a professor of Bible in Amsterdam. So I said, come, I'll show you around. So he came, and I didn't give him any introduction. I just took a yarmulke out and put it on his head, and I brought him into the Beit HaMidrash. Now you must understand what happens. I was very naughty because I didn't give him any introduction whatsoever, what he was going to see and experience over there. Now if this man, obviously, when he thinks he's walking into a place where there's Talmudic thinking and discussion or better learning taking place, that's similar to a university. And what is the great rule in the library of the university? Silence. Absolute silence. And therefore he thinks that when he walks into this big place where all these young people are probably, you know, very quietly discussing things with each other. And he walks in, war. Shouting. Walking around nervously, arguing with each other, even against the rabbis. What are you speaking about? You don't understand what this Gemara is all about, and the other one is getting this sort of thing. And it is an unbelievable scenery there. And the young man, this friend of mine, turns around and says to me, what is this? A demonstration against the British government? And I said, no. I said, what we are doing over here is we are discussing what God said at Sinai a few thousand years ago. And his mouth falls open and his eyes look to him and he says, you still don't know? And I tell him, indeed, we still don't know. We are still discussing this. There are so many opinions what God said. And I tell you more than that. That's the reason why we Jews are still around today. As long as we keep on discussing these matters, it stays alive. The moment, like Maimonides, with all respect, did, to finalize it, it is the end of the Jewish tradition. And that, my dear friends, are two major issues. The Yud Gimel Ikarim of Maimonides, and the Mishnei Torah, and the whole dogmatic attitude which Spinoza encountered in Amsterdam, via Rabbi Shaul Mortera, was in fact the death blow on Spinoza, because he couldn't fit into this. He was too brilliant. He realized, we don't know how much Jewish education he had. It is not true that he was already being educated as a rabbi, but they definitely wanted him to become a rabbi. We don't know how much Talmud he learned. We don't know how much Kabbalah he learned. He probably learned some of all that stuff from the other rabbi, Rabbi Aboaz de Fonseca, whatever it was. But in this man's mind, this brilliant mind, it didn't go. He didn't have the space. There was not enough there. It was all Maimonides. It was all dogma. And he couldn't live with it. And nobody at the time was able to pull him out of that and say to him, wait a moment, this is a little different. And then a tremendous tragedy happens. They put him into a van. He leaves. He doesn't seem to care at all. At least that's what the impression he makes. He lives there in the non-Jewish world, writes these two important works, the Ethics and the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, and starts there a war against the Jewish tradition, against Maimonides, against this whole concept of codification and so on, and start to say things about the Jewish tradition which are just not true. Where he was saying things Some of it, I dare to say, he probably knew that he was not telling the truth. Other things he probably did not know because he was not properly informed. I'll give you one example. In the Tractatus, Spinoza writes about the fact that the whole Jewish tradition is built on one principle. Obedience. You just have to do what you are told to do. Vraag niets, geen kastjes, as they say. Don't ask any questions. This is what you need to do. Is the Jewish tradition really about obedience, just like that? David Chazoni, sitting over there, his brother, Yoram Chazoni, just published a book, a remarkable book. You must read it. It is called The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture, where he takes note of Spinoza's critique on the Jewish tradition and says that Spinoza had it wrong. Obedience? The whole of Tanakh is one great story of disobedience to God. We read yesterday in the Parashat HaShavua that Avraham Avinu has a whole discussion with God about Sodom and Amorah, where he argues with him and he says, God, you can't do this. This is not good for your PR. How are you going to justify yourself? In the Talmud, there are loads of stories about rabbis who defeat God in an argument, in a halachic argument. The prophets constantly get up and say to God, you have got it wrong. And the beauty about the Jewish tradition is that every time when that happened, God never says, mind your own business, I'm the boss. He doesn't say that. He says to Abraham yesterday in the Parashat HaShavua, Abraham, so what do you have to say? I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham says, God, can we speak about 40 tzaddikim, 40 righteous people? Perhaps you can live with that. And God says, fine, but I'm sorry to tell you, there are no 40. And Abraham starts to say, what's about 30? What's about 20? This is a remarkable God. This is a God who is prepared to go into a discussion with man, who wants to know what man thinks, how is he defending himself, and he's open to that kind of an argument. And I can tell you for sure, in Christianity, in the Islam, you don't find anything at all. We Jews argue with God. And sometimes God says, there's a Talmud like that, he says, my children have defeated me, my children have defeated me, they were right and I was wrong. And by the way, if you look in my money desk, it's so interesting. My money desk there, indeed, says the halacha is in according to the rabbis against God. If you realize that, I'm not sure what he did over there. But it's so interesting. Every time again, you see enormous discussions between God and man. There's an uncertainty there. There's a risk principles there. There is constant continuation of all sorts of things. Obedience, just like that. Yes, on the end, there are cases, no doubt, where God said, you know, I've heard all your arguments, and I'm telling you, they don't work. The halacha is like me. But for the rest, he leaves most of halachic decision up to the rabbis, and the rabbis decide on what the halacha is, and therefore there is a lot of differences of opinion about all that. And while it is true, don't misunderstand me, that we need to have some kind of conformity in halacha. We can't just do everything. I can't just go by this rabbi and you go by that rabbi because there won't be a Jewish community like that. So there is a need sometimes to say, okay, I will have to give in, you give in there. And in that way we create some kind of a community, especially in exile. I have to say much more about that later if there's time for it. So in the meantime, we live by a certain rule. Yes, we need that. But actually that's not so ideal because the real ideal is that every human being makes his own personal connection with God through the many different opinions which are found in the Talmud. All that somehow fails as far as Spinoza is concerned because Spinoza doesn't seem to know about this. And if he did know, then he was not telling the truth. I'm going to do something very arrogant. I'm going to quote my own book. Hear this. The greatness of the sages of the Talmud was that they were sharing with their students their own struggles, their own doubts, how they tried to solve them and failed and sometimes succeeded. They created tension in their classrooms, waged war with their own ideas and asked the students to fight with them with knives between their teeth. They were not interested in teaching the students dogmas, but instead asked them to take them apart, to deconstruct them, to rediscover the questions behind all that. These teachers realized that not all paradoxes can be solved because life is full of paradoxes. And they also realized that every answer is always a form of death, because there's no continuation of a discussion anymore. That's what the rabbis really do in the Talmud. That's the marvelous thing about the Talmud, the ongoing war of intellectual and of principles, of ideas, which are floating around life left and right, and that is what we are basically doing in the yeshiva, the continuation of that particular discussion. But Spinoza doesn't want to hear about that, because Spinoza has been already dogmatized about this particular Jewish tradition by his rabbis, by his rabbis, and probably also because he wants, and there he, Spinoza starts to play a very dangerous kind of game, he wants to also find great honor in the eyes of the Christian world living around him, that he was the one who stood up against that Jewish tradition with all its dogmas and all its laws, and he wanted to prove that he was not of that kind. Spinoza writes like this: how blessed would our age be if it could witness a religion freed of all the trammels of superstition. He means the Jewish tradition. One of the great philosophers of our days, died a few years ago, who taught the last years in Hebrew University, was Emil Feckenheim. Perhaps you've heard him. He was one of the great philosophers of the Holocaust. And Feckenheim correctly writes like this, writing about Spinoza: how blessed might Spinoza's philosophy have been had it transcended all the bias against the religion which his conscience had forced him to forsake. How true. The story was not honest. More than that, also Spinoza continues then to make Christianity, liberal Christianity, into the ultimate philosopher's religion, and the Jewish tradition into something very simplistic. And what he does there is to say something like this. When he writes about Christianity and he writes about all the Christians who do terrible things, he says, that's not the fault of Christianity. It is just those Christians who don't live by all these liberal Christian ideas. But when he starts to attack the Jewish tradition, he doesn't say it were the Orthodox Jews who did not live up to the Jewish tradition, but it was the Jewish tradition itself which was at fault. That was just not honest. That is not what it is all about. But I'll tell you something else. Spinoza has a very interesting concept. He speaks about that. That's the kind of impression he wants to make about himself also. And don't misunderstand me. Spinoza is an unbelievable great personality. He writes about that people should look into this word sub specie alternatis. That's Latin, which means to say, to see things from the perspective of eternity. Don't get involved in all the little things in life. Take a step back, look in, and say again, you know, let's look to this from a perspective of eternity. Is this really important? And he lives his life like that. And he seems to live up to it. He was some kind of a secular tzaddik, I would even say. But there was one problem with Spinoza. Forgive me for saying this. Spinoza was not married. He had no children. He lived in his little world over there in Vorburg, in a few rooms, and he was writing there about eternity. But I once said in a lecture which I gave on Spinoza in Amsterdam University, I said, what would have been if Spinoza, like I have grandchildren, I have even great-grandchildren. They sometimes stay with me. And in the middle of the night, I have to get out of my bed to look one after that, and I step on one of their toys. And it hurts. Sub speti alternatis? Is this the reality of life? That's beautiful for Spinoza, if you have no grandchildren. If you are not married. If you don't have the more normal day-to-day situations of human existence, then you could write the most fantastic philosophy. But as they say, Le Meise, down here, the world is a little different. But that's not what Spinoza wants to get into. He lives in his own little world, which is fantastic because it includes the whole of the universe. But let's not forget one thing. Abraham Joshua Heschel said this once. He says you have to realize the beauty and the greatest, the power of the Jewish tradition is that it's a tradition, a religion about sanctifying trivialities. The little things in life which make up you and my life. We don't think only about big things, about God and eternity. We think about the very fact that they're only there down here in this world. We live with day-to-day life, with our children make us trouble, and about Parnassah and everything else. So Heschel said, the teaching of the Jewish tradition is the theology of the common deed. Of the common deed. That's so beautifully stated. Because that's what it is, and Spinoza completely missed that point. And by the way, very quickly, there was another thing about this Spinoza. Spinoza did something with, and again, Maimonides plays a big role over there. If you read Maimonides, the More Nebuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, then he writes about God in a way as a Greek philosopher writes about God. He makes him in the ultimate source of everything, the creator behind everything. What Maimonides tries to do is to prove how great God is. And he nearly disconnects him from the down-to-earth situation in the world in which we happen to live. But he just stops in time. And what Maimonides, better what Spinoza does is, he picks up Maimonides' concept about God, it's a Greek idea, and he pushes it over the border and completely disconnects God from the world. And by that he creates pantheism. Deus sive natura. God is equal to nature. God is gone. You know what God is? God became a Marano. He is no longer there. He's hidden. He's away. Spinoza is writing here his own story about the Maranos of his forefathers who went through this kind of situation and doesn't realize that he's projecting a Marano image on this God. And God is gone. Now what has this to do with the Kotzkerabbe? Good question, huh? I tell you, I have only a few more minutes left. That's a big problem. I am of the opinion, and I'm sure that all the experts in Spinoza will say that this is complete nonsense. But I think it is very serious. The big problem about Spinoza is that he was completely excluded from the rest of the Jewish world. He only knew Amsterdam. Nothing more than that. Even the rabbis didn't have any relationship with what happened in Poland and in Lithuania and all the other places in the world. They were living their little life. You know, the Dutch Jews used to say that Amsterdam is the Jerusalem of the West. They thought that the whole of the Jewish world was found within Amsterdam. It was not true at all. But that's how they thought about this. And what happens is that Spinoza has one great disadvantage. Not only that he doesn't have any relationship with the world out there, and one of my big questions towards him is, why didn't you try to make connections with the great rabbis living in the Eastern world and ask them their opinions before you would make an end to your Jewish connection? Perhaps they have something over there. The Maharal, also the Maharashah, also the tremendous great thinkers. You didn't know about them? Didn't you? Shouldn't you have looked for them and to see perhaps they have an answer to your questions? He didn't do that. It was also obviously very difficult in these days to do anything like that. But what would have been if Spinoza would have lived 150 years later at the time when the Hasidic masters came about? And remember, the Hasidut as we know it today has very little to do with the earlier kind of Hasidism as it once was there, because the people there, the great Hasidic rebbes, starting with the Baal Shem Tov and afterwards with the Kotzke Rebbe and some other tremendous great people, I tell you, if you read their stuff as I do, yes, well, today if they would write anything like that in the Orthodox Jewish world, they would all be called heretics. But they wrote this from a deeply religious perspective. And my question is therefore this. what would have been if Spinoza would have met the Kotzke Rebbe? What would have been if he would have met some of the other great rabbis at the time who had the most unusual ideas about the Jewish tradition? Sometimes they walked just on the edge of things, about halacha and about religious experience and things like that, which in the Lithuanian world they would never dare to write, but they did write it within the Hasidic world. And the Kotzke Rebbe was a phenomenal personality, and he reminds me of Spinoza, Lavdil. He also lived this sub-Eternatus. He also lived in a little cave somewhere for many, many years and had little to do with the world out there, which was actually not very Jewish. But he produced some most remarkable ideas about what it meant to live in absolute truth, in religious truth. And there were also people with that. And I wait. I have 3 more minutes, I'm just told. In 3 more minutes, I throw in an idea which I really have to speak about for a few hours. And I will do that after the classes are over. There was one great rabbi. He was called Reb Mendel Rimanov. A fantastic personality. I tell you very quickly, and there I will stop and I will make a connection with Spinoza and we'll leave it there. And that is this. He asked the question, what did the Jews hear at Sinai when they stood there and they heard the Ten Commandments? What did they really hear? And you know what he answers? He says, they only heard the aleph of the word Anochi. Do you get it? Anochi, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. The aleph, they heard the aleph. The only letter in the Hebrew alphabet which you can't hear is an aleph. Only when you put a kamatz under it, when you put a segol under it, then it has you can pronounce it. But you can't say aleph, there's nothing to say. So he says, they only heard the aleph. And the rest said to Moshe Rabbeinu, go you and find out what God is saying, because this is too overwhelming for us. We can't deal with the aleph. But the aleph can't be pronounced. So what did God say? The answer is nothing. But how do you translate the aleph into human language? There comes the great translator called Moshe Rabbeinu, who came down from Sinai and said, I tell you what the aleph is all about. Because the aleph is a vav and 2 yuds. Vav, yud, yud is 26, which is the word for God, the name of God. God is the aleph. And for the rest, there is nothing else in this world. Ein ot mile vado. God is the only one. All what we are or in God, or whatever name you want to give it, panentheism it is called. But what it means is that there is only God. And my dear friends, that is exactly what Spinoza said. It was exactly the point Spinoza was making. On the end, there is only God. He put that in terms different from the Jewish tradition by saying it is pantheism in the form of that God therefore has no personality. In the Jewish tradition we say it, he has personality, you can actually speak to him. But Spinoza is not so far out of the Jewish tradition as which most experts on Spinoza have made him into, including the rabbis. And that's the tragedy of this man. They could have kept him in. I finish with the following observation. Why is this also important? Because if we continue to teach the Jewish tradition purely by dogmatism, by codification, by laws, and we don't hear the music about it, and we don't understand the aleph behind it, then I can tell you for sure, and I speak with a lot of experience, tomorrow we will produce more Spinozas in our religious world. Because they will neither go for all this dogmatism and for not being able to speak their minds and being told you can't say this because you don't have an authority to say this. Oh, this is completely against the Jewish tradition. And therefore we must be careful that we don't repeat the mistake which the Mahamat made a few hundred years ago in the Portuguese Spanish synagogue in Amsterdam. We can't afford something like this. We must be able to keep the Spinozas inside and to become the Gedolei Hador, the great rabbis of our days, because they have the brilliance to do so. May God may bring this about. I thank you.